All right, so when I was reviewing all the material that we did last week, and we're in the midst of this whole discussion about Vashti, so it came to my mind, is there a story behind the story? In other words, we all know the Vashti story. And, you know, whether you go into, it's too bad Naomi's not here, you go into the Midrashim, and so on and so forth. No matter how you go into it, there you kind of walk away saying, really? This was reason enough to have the whole cabinet meet, and it became a crisis, and could it just be because he's just such a paranoid individual and such a male weakling with such a radical ego? Is that really what Megillat Esther is trying to teach us? And obviously, in my mind, I said to myself, I don't think so. I think there's more than the psychological, I said to myself. There's got to be something fundamental that needs to be explored.
God's plan.
Well, yeah, that's the end game. Okay, that's the end game. But why was there a heavy-duty cabinet meeting? Why did they have to figure out what to do? Right? Because after all, on a certain level, Ahasuerus simply could have said, to quote Lewis Carroll in Through the Looking Glass, off with her head. But he didn't do that. There had to be a whole discussion. Exactly. Had to be a Gans Megillah. And so, part of the story is revealed, if you'll take this sheet, at least a different approach is revealed in Rabbi David Foreman's book, The Queen You Thought You Knew, Unmasking Esther's Hidden Story. I happen to have it in the Kindle version, which is significantly less expensive than the non-Kindle version. And it's very funny. Although Rabbi Foreman lives within 10 minutes of my house and gives shiurim at the Young Israel, I found out about Rabbi Foreman from my very close friend in Toronto, Rabbi Michael Skoback, who said,
"Oh wow!"
He said, "David, have you read this book?" And I said, "What book?" And he tells me the name of it, and he goes, "And you know what? He's in your neighborhood." I said, "This really makes a lot of sense. I have to talk to my chavrusa in Toronto about someone who lives 10 minutes away from me." And I said, "Well, is it really the kind of book?" He goes, "How often do I tell you to buy anything? Buy and read this book." So I did. And something, Baruch Hashem, just stuck in my mind. So if you look on the other side, you will see what's stuck in my mind. This is a footnote. Mm-hmm. And this footnote addresses precisely what my lurking suspicions were. Now, I don't know at this point in time, since I read the book 3 years ago, I don't know if it was just in my mind and it sort of, in a sense, it set the stage for my searching, or this was really sort of, in a sense, a rediscovery, a new discovery. I'm not sure. That I can't tell you. But I'm going to show you by a very careful read of Rabbi Foreman's footnote that there are actually four different steps here that go into the essence of why the Vashti refusal became so highly significant. I read it very carefully. Let's just first take a simple read. The king's advisors counsel that Vashti must go, okay? Because if she stays, she sets a toxic example. Women will emulate her, and it will begin to defy their husbands. The social order will collapse. Okay? Now, if it wasn't a footnote, there'd be a new paragraph now. While to modern ears the fears expressed by the king's advisors seem somewhat silly and exaggerated, okay, and thinking of 21st century Jewish women compared, or even 21st century society of the West, okay, they certainly seem exaggerated. They seem to reflect an awareness that as the queen, Vashti really is Mother Persia. As first lady of the realm, her example matters. For better or for worse, what she says and does defines the values for which Persia stands.
Makes sense.
Okay?
It does make sense.
Now, when viewed through this lens of discernment from Rabbi Forman, I'm going to review the four major ideas that are here momentarily. Suddenly, the Vashti refusal to come out dancing with only her crown begins to make a lot of sense. Here's what happens, and here's really what Rabbi Forman is saying. There's four ideas. One, Vashti is Mother Persia, and she has set what will be perceived as a toxic example. That's big idea number one. Okay? Now, it so happens that I recently finished watching the wonderful series called The Queen. Okay? The Crown. The Crown. Right? The Crown. And that's an amazing series. It happens to be available on Netflix, for example. And the way that Rabbi Forman is describing Vashti as Mother Persia clearly is what's being presented in The Crown, that the queen or the king is the embodiment of the country.
But that was then, not now. Now it's just a...
Even today, watch the series if you have an opportunity.
It's
not like a figurehead thing. I mean, it's not.
She represents.
It's a figurehead that represents the entire nation.
The monarchy.
But I don't think people try to copy her.
They do.
They do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
She's the monarch.
Aristocracy in Great Britain is, you know, it still is all over. It's still followed. And listen, look what we did in America with Downton Abbey and everything. We can't get enough of the Brits. We just can't get enough of them. But at any rate, leaving that aside, the Queen in England certainly sets an example, right, as for better or for worse, as to what England is. Well, Vashti had the potential to set a good example or a bad example. What example does she set within the minds of the cabinet? A bad example. A toxic.
To us,
it's women's lib. It's the first step to women's lib.
Well,
actually just personally.
You know what? It, on a certain level, it really wasn't. Because as I've shown you from Chazal, the women's lib argument falls by the wayside. She was more than happy to go out in her crown. She didn't mind. She's no different than today's celebrities.
Lo busha.
She didn't care whatsoever, okay? But there were certain intervening factors. She wasn't asked correctly, right, and so forth. There, you know, that's the simplest way. That's what, as I mentioned, that's what Rav Soloveitchik says. Had Ahasuerus come to her and said, "My dear, would you honor us with your presence as queen of the realm, wearing but your crown?" We already saw in the Gemara. She was happy to do that. But she wouldn't come because she was mistreated in her mind. Okay? So at any rate, here's the thing. Okay? Quote unquote, using a 21st century term, what's the spin going to be? The spin is going to be simply that she refused to come. And here's a woman refusing to follow her husband's orders, in quotation marks. Okay.
But she knew that she was royalty and he was a nothing.
She did.
And that's probably why she was quite irritated with him not asking her properly.
Correct. That's it. We discussed that.
Yeah.
We discussed precisely that.
Money is power.
Correct.
But she was the money. Without her, he didn't have
look, it. Look, she wasn't... She wasn't just a princess. She was centerfold level, which is, of course, what Chapter 2 is all about. Go out and find the most beautiful girls in the world. Okay? So this is who Ahasuerus is. He's a lowlife, scuzzball. You know, we know that. But he wanted to show her off. And she personally didn't mind. Okay, the next step was... Rabbi Foreman says, women would emulate her. Not knowing why or what, but women would emulate her. Okay? Now, again, I think we do have to take away that she was liberated. She wasn't liberated. She just knew what protocol was. Because were she to be truly liberated, would she voluntarily want to objectify herself and come out in but her crown? No. I don't see anything liberating about that. I just see that as, you know, a human being turned into a piece of meat, okay, which is, of course, a really big problem.
But would these other women put themselves on the same level as her? Say, well, she did... I mean, if the first lady did something, that doesn't mean... whether it's the proper thing or not, I probably would not copy her, even though that's the, you know, I'm only using the first lady because I guess that would be the, so we don't have a king and queen here.
But even if it was like a regular person, because we see in some of these societies today, if a woman isn't dressed properly, she'll be beaten up in the street or whatever. So it's kind of like everyone has to be made an example of. So if she does something, people might think that they could defy their husband, so... It's like a kal vachomer. If a regular person in the street doesn't listen to her husband, she'll get beaten up. So it's even more so. She's the queen. So like she's
but I'm not
more
on the same level as the queen.
But you want to be.
But let's give an example. I remember very well because I was a big JFK fan.
During
Camelot, I remember suddenly every woman you saw walking around had a Jackie hairdo.
And a pillbox.
Yes,
okay.
And a hat.
And a pillbox. Okay. I remember it.
No, just look.
I remember it.
How many pictures they
all. You know, I remember like yesterday.
She was the closest we got to a queen.
Correct. Right. Yes. And
yes, an elegant, educated.
She, I mean, she, you know, really, she really buried JFK. I don't mean literally, but she buried JFK in terms of her fine kite and everything else. She really did, obviously. Because after all, how did JFK get his money? Through violating prohibition on his father's side. That's how he got his money. Whereas Jacqueline, right, went back. She was old, rich money. Okay? At any rate, number three. Once women would emulate her, they would defy their husbands. Now, you have to understand what that meant culturally. Women were subordinate. Okay? Now, by the way, I am not making, in any of this, any value judgments. I'm just simply talking what the history was. So please don't misunderstand, okay? But women would defy their husbands. And here's the big, big issue. If women would defy their husbands, the social order would collapse. That's why this became a state affair. So you have these, you have one thing leading into another.
She became the example.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Vashti sets an example, good or bad, but this time it was deemed to be toxic. Two, women would emulate her. Three, in emulating her, they don't know why she defied her husband, but they would say, well, if the queen could do it, I can do it too. And last but not least, that would be the end of the social order. Now we understand it's not just a personal thing on Ahasuerus' part. Now, was he intelligent enough himself to really understand the ramifications of all that? Probably not. But remember, his cabinet didn't become his cabinet because they were dumb cuffs like he was. Okay? They were very... He was shrewd, but they were savvy.
Well, monarchs always, you know, through history, they make an example of people. Someone defies the the monarch than is public executions.
Yes, that's correct. That's 100% right, and that's happened throughout history. So once Mumu-Khan introduces that, and we're going to get to Mumu-Khan right now.
Okay.
Well, exactly. Very good. So, in fact, let's look in Ted Zion. You are cooking with gas. So it says, Vayomer Mumu-Khan. Now, Mumu-Khan, as I said last week, is Haman. Okay? And the Gemara itself...
I'm sorry, where are you?
We're right now in Tet Zion on Sipur Vashti Hamaka. Okay? We're on Tet Zion, so it's on the other side. Okay? So the Gemara, which I don't actually have this particular Gemara down for you because it's all of three words. The Gemara says in Megillah Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet, Mumu-Khan Zehaman. Very straight. Okay? That's really the overarching view of who he was. So this is his moment. He is basically, Haman is a complete, total, absolute thug. He's a Hitlerian figure. He's a Stalin, right? He's, don't forget, Stalin, after the war, murdered 6 million Russians. Okay? After the war. Okay? I mean, that's the kind of individual Haman was. Okay? And that's who Mumu-Khan was. So, now, how does a thug, a complete violent thug, rise up the ranks?
He gets rid of everybody underneath him.
True.
Well, Hitler did the same thing.
Yeah. Exactly. And what does he need most of all?
Comrades.
Comrades and chaos.
Oh, chaos.
He needs chaos. If there's chaos, right? If there's chaos, then it allows for someone with brute force to rise.
To get control.
And to take control. And you know, and I know, that Haman understood Ahasuerus very well. He knew what Ahasuerus needed to feed his habit of wine, women, and song, right? He knew that while Ahasuerus was shrewd, he wasn't very bright, and he knew that most of all he loved power. So we're going to see those themes throughout the entire Megillah. Okay, so this is how he now speaks up. And look what he says. Vayomer Mumu-Khan lifnei ha-melech v'hasarim. So you bet your bottom dollar that took a certain amount of temerity. He figured, this is my moment. This is my chance. I will be that person who rides off into the sunset on the noble horse because I'm going to get the king on my side. Okay. Lo ahamelech levado. So what he did is he took something the king had personalized and he turned it into a holistic error and failing that would affect the entire realm. If it affects the entire realm, okay, what happens to what one of the things that Ahasuerus loves most? His power base begins to erode. So look carefully how he starts his argument. Brilliantly, okay, Machiavellian without any question, but he's brilliant. Lo al hamelech levado, right? He afta Vashti Hamalka. Vashti the queen did not do what you and I would have called an avon. Afta is a verbal form of the word avon. It means a sin. Commit a grievance. Okay? So it's not only against, okay, the king did Vashti the queen perform a wrong, but rather, that's level one. Don't worry, king. I'm with you. I know how you feel. I understand. So he plays the sensitive card momentarily, right? And notice, by the way, what's under the word hamalka, if you look in the text, is an etnacht. That's the end of an idea. So in other words, he let that sink in. That was an idea. King, I'm with you, man. You and I, we're buds. We're going to get through this somehow. That's number one. So he's creating a sensitivity and, if you will, what they call today in the 21st century, a bromance. So it's not just...
Oh, wow.
Right? Is that not true?
It's bizarre as that sounds, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Is it not true that it's not just you? Although I'm not denying that, King. Understand, I know how you feel. But rather, ki al kol hasarim. But she's done a wrong against all the princes of the realm. And by the way, who do you think the cabinet members were? They weren't Joe the Garbage Man and Irving the Plumber. They were of nobility.
Kesef.
Right? And they were rich and all that. So don't think it's just you, King, but it's also all the princes. So everybody else in the cabinet sits there and goes, yeah, that's me too. I didn't realize that.
Don't leave me out.
Right. Don't leave me out. Notice how inclusionary he's being. Brilliant strategist. Really. You know, you have to admit that's what he was. V'alkol ha'amim. So not only that, but all the people. Don't think it was just Shushan, but it was all the people. Asher b'chol medinot, in all of the countries. Ha'melech ha'chashverosh. Of the king, Achashverosh. So notice how careful he's being. He could have said, Kol medinot ha'melech. But look at the kavod. Look how crafty he's being. He's buttering him up. He's really buttering him up. I'm with you. I recognize your power. You're the king, right? But it wasn't just you. As important as you are. And notice, who does he mention first? It wasn't just on the king alone. Ted Zion, Yud Zion. Okay, now, by the way, with the read that we got before from Rabbi Foreman, now you're going to see how it all actually really fits into the text. Okay? Ki yitze davar hamalka al kol hanashim. Because this is going to be propagated throughout all the lands in 127 countries. And who's going to hear about it?
The women.
All the women. And what are these women going to do? Now, obviously, by the way, you're learning a whole lot here about male-female relationships back in about 500 years before the year zero. We're not talking here about partners, equal partners. We're talking about, depending on the level, we're talking about what's called in psychology, an asymmetric relationship. Mm-hmm. There's power, and they're relatively powerless. Mm-hmm. Okay? Funny. Okay? That's what we're talking about. And what he says is, all the women, what are they going to do? Lahavzot ba'alehen. They are all going to treat their husbands, okay, with disdain. Because what's the nounal form of the word? Lahavzot? Bizayon. They're all going to treat their husbands with disdain. Be'enehen. And you know what happens then? Use your imagination. Okay? Now, because what's going to take place? Ba'amram ha'melech Achashverosh, because they're going to hear that the king Achashverosh, Amar, said, Lahavi et Vashti ha'malka, that Vashti the Malka has to be brought lifanav before him, velo ba'a, and she didn't come. So she disobeyed a direct order of the king. What we call in Hebrew, right, when it comes to a legitimate Jewish king, we use the terminology Moreid B'Malchut, to rebel against the king. Okay? So she rebelled against the king. And if someone could rebel against the highest person in the land, well, what about you? You're just a squire, or you know, you're just a blacksmith, or whatever it might be. Okay? But again, you can. This is only really possible when you don't have mutual love and affection that this fear would even come about. Mm-hmm. Because if there's mutual love and affection, and most of all respect and dignity, one party to the other, right? Then what would the women do if they heard what the queen did? They'd say, she's a tifshai, okay? That's how she wants to treat her husband? I would never think of treating my husband that way. Because after all, would he ever treat me the way the king treated Vashti? No. So, but that's not what was going on 500 years before the year zero. Mm-hmm. Okay? Next step. V'hayom hazeh, and on this very day, tomarna sarot parasumadai, the princesses, meaning, don't forget, who is being obliquely referred to here? Princesses?
All the women.
Right, Vashti. She was the princess who became the queen. So if this princess could do it, in every little, you know, country, there's other princesses. So on this very day, Tamarna Sarot Parasu Madai, the princesses of Paras, of Persia, Madai, and Media will say, okay, I share Shamu et Devar Hamalka, okay, after having heard all of what took place regarding the queen, who again represented Mother Persia, L'chol Sarei HaMelech, they're going to say to their husbands, similar in kind as Vashti herself did. See how these psukim are coming alive? Mm. Okay? I mean, they're just new psukim now. We really can see something different. Ukedai, let me just make sure I got that right. Ukedai, right? Ukedai, Vizayon Viketsev. And they're going to be involved with what? They're going to be involved with nothing but contempt and wrath shown at their husband, which essentially means a breakdown of what?
Society
and social order. Got it? So the reading, I think, of Rav Forman is strongly supported by the actual words. The question is, do you see them in those words? And I think now we can. Okay, so let's turn the page. Now that Haman, alias Mamukhan, has set the stage, he's about to move one step further. Now, suffice it to say, by the way, strategically, if Haman, Mamukhan, can get rid of Vashti and then cozy up to the king, so at that moment, when the king doesn't have Vashti, he doesn't have his play toy, he doesn't have his object of interest, so that's going to be a period of time when Haman can increase his relationship with the king, because he's going to feel a loss. So therefore, what does Mamukhan suggest? Im al hamelech tov. King, you're going to make this decision. It's not up to me. If it's good for the king, yetze devar malchut melefanav. Okay, let a statement of the king go forth from before him. Ve'yich, let's see again, I have to just, here we go. Ve'yichtev bedatei, and let it be written in the laws of Parasumadai. Right? V'yikatev, excuse me, thank you. V'yikatev bedate parasumadai. And let it be written in the laws of parasumadai. V'lo yavor. And it can never be violated. Asher, And that's one of the keys of this dictatorship. Mm-hmm. Anything the king says
stays.
Mm-hmm. It's written in stone. Maybe in 500 years before the year zero, almost sometimes it probably was. So Asher lo tavo, that it has to be recorded. Asher lo tavo Vashti, the Vashti never came. Lifnei HaMelech HaChashverosh. So he's really, in a sense, what's he doing? He's needling.
He didn't say Malka,
isn't he?
Either.
Say again?
He didn't say Malka either. He didn't say Malka Vashti or Vashti Malka.
Right. All we have now is
just Vashti.
Vashti. She's completely become now no longer Mother Persia. As far as the people there are concerned, she's no longer the queen.
She's like marginalized. Right?
Marginalized, objectified. She's just a thing.
Dead meat.
She's, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay? And ready? That's step number one. Everyone's got to know what she really did. Step number two, and that's why I separated the pasuk. Umalchuta, and let her queenship, if you will, Yitein HaMelech, be given over by the king, L'Re'uta, to her friend, to her compatriot, Hatova Mimena, who's better than she. Well, in what way will she be better than Vashti?
She'll listen to the man.
Obedient, compliant,
subservient,
powerless. All the things that, if you have daughters, or if you don't have daughters, you have daughter-in-laws, or you're going to want daughter-in-laws, all the things that any healthy woman that you and I would know, all those kinds of behaviors that you and I would reject out of hand. But at this time, that would be Tova Mimena. Because after all, you couldn't be more beautiful than Vashti. She was already the best of the best, the top of the top. Whoever you want to think of, I'm not even going to start naming names, because then your question would be, and you know about her, Rabbi? Okay? But whoever it might be in your mind. Okay? So that's not what we're talking about. We're not looking for someone who's more beautiful. We're looking for someone who's more compliant, subservient, submissive. Okay? That's what he's looking for. Okay?
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
I don't know the rules of royalty, but if she was queen and he became king by marrying her, if she's no longer around, he still stays king?
Yes.
It's not like once if you get divorced, the widow, you're no longer part of.
No, because what you're thinking of, again, to go back to the series we're talking about, the crown, you're thinking of a consort. So when the queen is married to someone who's not part of the line in England, he can never be the king. He's only the consort.
Like Philip can never be king.
Correct.
It goes to the son.
Correct.
Because he wasn't royalty beforehand?
No, Philip was aristocracy. But he wasn't in the bloodline of the king of England. So he can never be king. Okay? Now.
Okay, so then how did he become king if he was queen, if he was a stable boy?
Because in those days.
Very sly guy.
Right? In those days.
He bought his way in.
He bought his way in. He killed his way in. He bludgeoned his way in. And once in those days of absolute unmitigated violence, once a person did such a thing, and they were king. They were king.
Yeah, and people would be afraid to.
Because he had his the equivalent of his SS troops, 100%.
If he does this, people are going to be afraid. If he can do this to his wife, what's he going to do to anybody?
Right.
Persian mafia.
Yeah, but didn't that king have to abdicate because he wanted to marry a commoner or the prince?
Well, that was the king of England prior to. Right? Yeah. Yeah, someone did that. He abdicated because he married a girl. But that's not the rule anymore in England. Now.
History was not my strong point.
And in fact.
That was during the Nazi reign, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Part of the biggest problem. He felt Hitler was doing a great job.
Well, that was also part of it.
Yeah.
Right? But that's not for the whole conversation now.
He didn't deserve it.
Let's continue with Chaf. Okay, v'nishmat pitgam ha-melech. Okay, and let the statement of the king be heard. Asher ya'aseh b'chol malchuto, that will be propagated throughout his entire kingship. Okay, and notice again, look how what a wheedling, conniving, false, flattering, thus and so, this fellow is. Kirabahi, he's giving him a compliment. In the midst of talking about what he should do, he's giving him a compliment. After all, king, look how powerful you are. V'chol hanashim, and all the women, yitnu yikar l'baleihem, that the rule should be, all of the women must give honor and respect to their husbands. L'migadol v'ad katan, from the greatest to the smallest. What will that ensure everybody? The maintenance of what?
Obedience. Power.
Social order.
Social order. Okay?
Their idea of social order.
Social order. I'm not at, please don't walk out of here saying, I don't know what's wrong with a rabbi is advocating such a crazy way to, no. I'm not advocating it. Okay, I'm just saying this is 500 or so BCE. Okay? Now, the king, after all this flattery, and after ensuring that there's going to be a way that he's going to keep his power, he's a happy camper. And look what it says. Vayitav adavar be'enei ha-melech v'hasarim. And the matter was pleasing in the eyes of the king and his princes. Because after all, everybody is going to be taken care of. V'ya'as ha-melech k'dvar m'muchan. And the king did just like m'muchan suggested. Now, this is a double entendre. What are the two things that he actually did? One, he did send out, as we're going to see in Chaf Bet, he did send out an edict. Okay? He did do that. But there's something else he did. And what do you think that something else was? What do you think that was? What happened to Vashti?
She was killed.
When was she killed? Right now. Chazal say that in Chaf Aleph, in the Medrash, this was the moment that she's executed. Now, how was she executed? I knew you were all asking that question because you found it fascinating. I discovered it completely, totally, accidentally when I was doing all my research. She was killed through the use of a discos. Now, you all, of course, know what a discos is, okay? This was something during the late 60s and 70s, right? A discos.
You mean like a frisbee?
No, that's what it sounds like, right?
It does.
Because discos, what language is discos, obviously?
Greek.
Okay, but it turns out it has two interpretations. Okay. One is a discos is, in fact, like the discus that's thrown in the Olympics.
Correct.
Okay? But you ready? What was the discos, according to the Medrash, that was employed? Basically, a 6th century BCE guillotine. Right? So, even though I'm not going to say someone had an axe to grind because it's too corny, but I would never say that. But even though there were other ways to take care of her, why would she be killed this way? So it turns out, according to the Torah Tamima and other commentators, discos was used solely for nobility because it was pashnished to kill nobility in a violent, vulgar way. So we had to do it in a very pleasant, way.
What's pleasant about that?
Well, because what they would do
about the British too.
It's right away. They were killed in different.
Yes.
First of all, isn't it instant?
Oh yes, exactly.
As opposed to hanging, which is not.
Which is not, or various other. I'm not going to go into because why should my friends all have bad dreams? But basically,
this is an upgrade in execution.
Correct. This is a major upgrade.
Okay.
Good for you. Because it was, in fact, what does the Torah Tumima actually call it? Mita Yafa. It was a pleasant way to die. Because apparently, without getting too graphic, okay, which weren't invented. Okay.
Oh, hemlock would have worked.
Yes, but that didn't happen until much later on. It's much later. There were always poisons, but they weren't, perfected yet. And poisons that weren't perfected, you'd get one of those deals like when we were kids and we saw the black and white movies with some, kind of thing, and it goes on for 20 minutes. So you don't want to do that to a noble person either. Right, exactly. So what apparently happened here was the noble person put their head into the discos and automatically, that's what happened. Okay? And that's what Chazal say. Now, I can't make this stuff up. That's what Chazal say. Now, you ready? Here's what takes place. Vayishlach Sfarim el kol medinot hamelech el, right? El medina u medina. And
why does it have to say medina if it just says kol medinot?
Okay, good question. I'm going to explain that in a minute, and that's a really good question. So, Sfarim, which means, we're not talking about full Sfarim, we're talking about divine edict wrapped up in a scroll. Okay?
It's like each and every one of them, right?
Right. So, these things were sent out to all the Medinot of the king. So, first, that's 127.
27 okay? Provinces, right?
Right. But you don't know that he go to every single place with every single language using every single script.
Gotcha.
That's a lot of scripts in the ancient world.
Right.
Right? It wasn't like today.
It takes some time.
That's why it says Al-Medina, Medina. Each and every little ballywick, kikit, dava, right? According to its script. So this country reads Sanskrit. Maybe there were still people in Egypt that were reading hieroglyphics. Okay, maybe there was, at this point in time, surely there was the Phoenician language. Mm-hmm. We know there was the Hebrew language. Everybody got it. Okay? Ve'al am u'am. Kilshono. Okay? So, every language, every script, and so forth. Now, what was the goal? Well, if you were your average 500 BCE... husband who was very, very happy with an asymmetric relationship, okay? Liot kol ish sorer beveto. He's the king of the castle. Okay, I'm always reminded by the famous line from my big fat Greek wedding where he says, he's the head of the house. And his wife says, he might be the head, but I'm the neck. Okay.
Sounds farty to me.
Okay. Well, it was Greek. It's Greek to me. So okay. So liot kol ish sorer beveito. Everyone should be the leader in the house. Umidaber kilashon amo. And not only that, you could be in this asymmetric relationship. So you happen to marry. You're a Phoenician, and you marry this gorgeous, Persian woman. So you don't have to learn her language,
she has to learn
your language. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, with all of this, we see that according to Rav Forman, it's good that this should take place because what you have is the government remains in place, okay, and everybody remains the head of their family in this rather violent, what you and I would call lack of relationship scenario. That's reforming. And therefore, social strata and the whole social construct of the time is intact. Soloveitchik had a different approach. His approach was this. He said, this was so important to come out because in the Rav's take on everything, at this point, everybody who had any intelligence whatsoever began to seriously doubt Ahasuerus's abilities. Mm-hmm. Why? Because as Rav Soloveitchik said, really? The government can ever pass a law about a husband and wife relationship? How they're supposed to interact with each other? Yes, the government can pass a law about what constitutes a marriage, what constitutes a divorce, what constitutes maternity, that's the easy one, what constitutes paternity. Sometimes that could be guesses, guess might. Okay? The law can have all that. But the law, no matter what the country is, even Russia, under, the communists, they didn't pass a law saying, here's how husbands and wives will talk to each other, and this is what's going to happen within the family.
In Mitzrayim, the same thing.
Okay.
This is what Paro did to the Bnei Yisrael.
Meaning
they were not to have any family relations, no children, no birthdays.
Well,
I thought that were a little different to my Hebrew school.
But he never said you can't have family relations. They decided, and then along came Miriam, who said, no,
you can't do this, right?
If you do this, you're killing everyone. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. And of course, and he was a Gadol Hador, and everything changed. Okay, so you have two different ways to look at this. Either it was viewed as a good idea, which is Rav Forman's approach, because society remained intact, or the psychological insight of Rav Soloveitchik is that this became the first major crack in Ahasuerus's perception by others, that in fact, if he's this foolish, how to think that he can actually legislate between man and wife, then he can't really be king material. Mm-hmm. Okay, and ultimately, by the way, Ahasuerus, who is probably Xerxes, okay, was in fact overthrown in real history, okay, in real secular history. He's not overthrown, of course, here. He, in fact, at the very last parak, that 10th parak, by that time we're all exhausted from listening to each and every word of the Megillah, not wanting to miss it. But in those last four or five psukim, right? Those last four or five psukim, it talks about how he gets power, more and more power.